You've seen the headlines. Bonds are making a comeback. But if you've ever tried to invest in bonds, you know what a clunky, complicated, broken experience it can be. That's why at Public, they took fixed income and fixed it. Now you can find, evaluate, and buy thousands of bonds with an investing experience designed this century. Add fixed income to your portfolio with corporate, treasury, and municipal bonds. Go to public.com/bondspodcast to get started. This podcast is sponsored by Public. Full disclosures can be found at public.com/bonds. Chat with Traders is sponsored by Trade the Pool. Are concerns about limited buying power, insufficient capital, or fear of losing your own money preventing you from advancing your trading capabilities? Trade the Pool is an online stock trading prop firm that offers funding for stock traders. Demonstrate your skills, trade their capital, and keep your profits. You can engage in intraday trading and now swing trading on Trade the Pool with any U.S. stock or ETF. The procedure is straightforward. Pay an evaluation fee, successfully complete the evaluation, and get funded. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
Markets, speculation, and risk. This is the Chat with Traders podcast, hosted by Aaron Fifield.
What's happening, crew? I'm glad to have you plugged in. Thank you very much for joining me on another episode of Chat with Traders podcast. On this particular episode, I have with me Mark Gardner. Mark's someone who began working in the field at just 17 years old, straight out of high school. Initially, he began with back office duties before broking on the floor of the Sydney Futures Exchange, or SFE. Then later, he was picked up by a very large bank bills trader to exclusively execute trades, and he learned a great deal from this particular trader. Around 2005, Mark began trading his own book. Over the 10 years that followed, Mark had only two losing months, and to date, he's never encountered a losing year. Though in 2015, he did suffer a substantial blow, losing months and months worth of gains in the space of just a few short hours, which you'll hear more about during the episode. Today, Mark is also a partner and the chairman of Genesis Trading, one of the larger prop firms in Australia, and he's also leading a new venture, 42 Trading, as a foray into quantitative trading, which currently consists of himself and a couple others. Also worthwhile of a mention is that Mark is the president of the Australian Securities Traders Association too. Now, throughout this episode, we speak about Mark's insane work ethic. And no, that's no exaggeration. We also get into lessons from his past, why he sees a future in quantitative trading, and plenty more. Here is my interview with Mark Gardner. Now, Mark, listeners won't know this, but we were actually supposed to record this episode about 24 hours ago. So I jumped onto Skype. I was hanging around waiting for you. And you sent me a message a couple hours later to say that you'd just kind of woken up, and it was about 4:30 p.m. in the afternoon, and you told me you'd just wrapped up a 50-hour or somewhere around 50-hour stint. I mean, what's the deal?
Essentially, it's a rollover period in the Australian market, which is a fairly profitable period for me generally in the past, and there's a lot of opportunity over that period, and I'm sort of trying to wrap up for a basically one of my first sort of extended 3-week break from the market in terms of switching the screens off and actually going and spending a lot of some dedicated time on the other projects. So there was a sense of urgency in terms of trying to tie things up towards the end of the week. But you know, I've got four children, which gave me a good boot camp in sleep deprivation anyway. But I'll do stints as opposed to if the market's good, I'll keep going, and then I'll conversely have a long sleep afterwards instead. So it's just a different routine. That's an extreme example, but I have a strike system where sort of laminated poster on the wall, which if I make three mistakes, errors, or poor judgment, and even including things of, if I miss a trade or I'm starting to drop in terms of sharpness, once I've got three three strikes, I basically wrap up immediately and go. So, but I'll try and sort of like ride a hot streak if I can, particularly when it's busy. So I've been in front of the screens for 20 years, and my autopilot tends to be pretty solid in terms of instinctive trading. So it's not something it's not pleasurable by any means. It's not something I really want to be doing, you know.
So these periods during rollover, these are like prime time opportunity for you?
Traditionally, it has been. In the last four quarters, my performance has actually dropped, and it's mainly technology-based in forms of stops and things. But in doing the analytics, there's a certain period where it started to become diminishing returns for me. But obviously, with interest rate markets and having people having to move positions further out the curve or having to roll, you know, 3-year and 10-year bond positions, it is the largest collection of traders who don't normally trade the market. They're the people who are on different time frames who aren't necessarily tick sensitive. So you can get someone who doesn't normally trade our market who just wants to roll their position and get out. So, you know, you can, I've always been a relative value trader generally. So you can take advantage of those short-term aberrations where, you know, which have been basically forced by people having to move their positions to the next contract. So,
and how often is the rollover?
It's every quarter in Australia, and it usually varies in length. Sometimes it'll be a short period of time, you know, maybe 4 days. It's a, you know, FIFO market here, like first in, first out queue position sort of thing. So given that I've basically been a screen trader for 20 years and have a fairly niche knowledge of the market, it's a good time to sort of take – it's an edge that I have because of my experience.
Okay. So I probably should have asked you this prior to asking that last question, but just so everyone is clear on this, what markets are you actually predominantly trading?
Short-term interest rate. So I used to trade Australian sort of bank bills in sort of butterfly or double butterfly structures. So essentially, they're fairly non-directional, and they're taking advantage of a price aberration over long periods of time. So you generally have 6 to maximum 8 point range in these strategies, but they're very much multi-legged. So they're fairly stable. So you do them in larger size, but there's been I've sort of moved away from that in the last year and a half. You know, the ranges have started to compact a little bit, and realistically, Australia was pretty late to the party in terms of having HFT and computerized and algorithmic trading come into our market, because we're one basis point to a point, as opposed to say bonds might be 7 or 8. I think 10-year notes are 2.5 or thereabouts. So the cost of execution is too great in terms of fill risk. So whereas in the markets that have got, you know, smaller increments, the systematic trading tends to do a lot better because it reduces the amount of risk if you have to take another point or if you miss a stop. So we've kind of been insulated somewhat, but there's been a definite increase in that sort of, you know, computerized execution and trading coming in the last 18 months. And I've sort of made the decision to move to, you know, more sort of quantitative and statistical based trading in line with, you know, what was the people that I'm competing against. So,
yeah, I mean, that's something I definitely want to speak to you about. So as we've kind of already touched on your work ethic, I actually just want to go into that a lot more, and then let's get more into your trading, because I'm very impressed by it. I don't know if it's something that I particularly want to try and adapt for myself, and I don't know if it's something that others should necessarily adapt for themselves.
It's not something that's necessarily I enjoy adapting to my trading either. So, you know, it's not an ideal thing, and lifestyle-wise, obviously not the greatest thing either.
Have you always had this kind of work ethic, like the willingness to put in such long hours and like excessively long stints behind the computer? Is that something that you've had kind of since day one when you were starting out trading, or is it kind of just evolved?
My parents, sort of, you know, fairly blue collar, work 7 days a week, and I guess wasn't really that was just what we did, you know, and I never really realized it. People went on holiday, you know, my father, I think, went 13 years straight or something without a without a sick day or a leave day or something, you know, ridiculous. So it's just an example of set by, you know, my parents were, you know, were very hardworking, and then I actually enjoy what I do, as difficult it is, and sometimes psychologically debilitating or tough it can be. I still enjoy trying to work it out, and it's also. I'm not exactly, after 21 years, I'm not, like, you know, I've seen the life cycle of traders, because I've only generally worked at smaller shops or prop shops or used to call locals on the floor, where it's been all individual traders. And, you know, there's very few that make it into their mid to late 40s or beyond. I mean, there's a few that do, but it's not the average. So it sort of is trying to take advantage of, squeezing the last blood out of the stone in terms of what I perceive as the winds of change and with my edge, like my execution, my legging skills and things like that have been extraordinarily good over the years. But I'm slowly seeing that edge disappear, and I'm trying to manage my own trading whilst also I've got a team of young guys who I'm developing the more systematic stuff with. So it's really a 50-hour shift thing. That's an absolute rarity. But I'm almost doing two jobs at the moment. That's what I have to do to manage the transition. And it really, I'm not particularly bothered by it. I enjoy work, and it's not really a chore in terms of I'm trying to work out the next phase and things like that. And yeah, it's not a big deal to me. But it's I get a little lectures about it, but. Yeah, it's not definitely not for everyone though. I mean, realistically, a lot of young guys who've come up who traded next to me, I'm very wary of that sort of three strike rule, particularly for them, like their decision making process, because old bull syndrome where they're trying to keep up and they don't have the hardwired experience just to go on autopilot, or they also haven't been through four babies in the house keeping you up all night either. So it's more something you get used to.
Okay. Now speak to us about this autopilot, how you describe this as autopilot, because I know a good friend of yours, Darren Reed, who was recently on the podcast also, I told him that I was going to be interviewing you. And this is actually one of the things he told or suggested that might be good to ask you about is, like, you've described your trading to him as though you go on autopilot at times when you put in these long hours. How are you able to do that? And where does that come from? Like, what do you mean when you're trading on autopilot?
Basically, because it's more of a high volume, low range sort of scenario. It's very much, I'm mindful of even how I've set up my screens in terms of fields of vision, like all the most important things and all the possible cheats in looking at the market and conditional formatting on spreadsheets and things to give me visual triggers to do a trade very swiftly, and making sure that I have things in the same spots. And I essentially have, 21 years, I think we worked it out, I know it's like 80,000 hours plus sitting in front of screens. So it's just time more than anything else. And it's almost like a gamer, what might be reflexes or pattern recognition. I've got to say, similar charts. So I've had the similar quote spreadsheet set up that I look at the entire strip, and then I've got the same charts next to those. And then those have been in the same position on my screens for 15 years, essentially, in slightly different variations. But that consistency of being able to see things out of the corner of my eye, and then that's, that's in the center of my vision field, and then I'll go further out to for things that are more that are sort of secondary importance, like, it might be currencies, or if we're trading on the back of crude or gold or whatever, and then those charts and those indicators will be that further out, and then all my longer term stuff, 2-year charts and things like that on certain sort of structures will be on peripheral screens. So basically everything's within reach if I need to, and then it's the consistency of having the same market, basically, and the same charts. The level of pattern recognition essentially has become fairly instinctive.
Okay, that's really incredible to hear that you've worked out like an approximate of how many hours you've put in over the last 15, 20 years. 80,000 hours. That's a lot of screen time.
Yeah. So I don't hold out too much hope for my vision in my 60s, but
What are some of the things you've done to try and avoid burnout? Like, is there anything you've consciously done?
Not particularly. I've got an active mind, so I've tried things like meditation courses and et cetera, and it has almost a reverse effect. Like, if I'm stimulated, I'm fairly relaxed, and as long as I'm spending time with, allocate time for my family and doing things with my daughters, and it's not I don't feel comfortable sitting on a beach or reading a book. Like, I'm actually enjoy being stimulated and learning new things. So it's not a burnout factor for me. And I'm working for myself. So it's not, there's motivation, obviously. If I was working, I obviously wouldn't be working anywhere near these hours if I was working for someone. So there's a motivation there to be innovative and try to find new things and improve my training and basically find new ways. If you enjoy it, or I wouldn't say love it, but if you feel as though it stimulates you and it's engaging, then I think burnout's much less of a factor for me. So, but if I had to do a very repetitive job, and I was working for someone else, and there was on a career path, then I would certainly be very susceptible to burnout. So it's more the fact that I'm lucky that I found something that it suits my personality in a way.
Now, I know you said a little earlier that these 50-hour stints is not something that you do too frequently, but, especially around rollover periods, it is something that you do. And Tony, one of the guys who works for you, he actually made me aware of you. He reached out, he listens to the podcast, and he suggested that you'd be someone we're worthwhile speaking to. And he told me he's seen you trade for like 3 days straight once. How do you actually stay awake for this long?
I think 3 days straight is an exaggeration. And he goes home and I get naps, power naps essentially. So I guess the story doesn't really fit the reality, in a way. But as much as you're focusing on it, it is definitely not something that most people can do, nor would I recommend it. It's not basically due to the intense repetition over such a long period of time that I can do. But it is like I would steer people towards. I tend to not use my time efficiently sometimes, but then I also will take, I'll take a day off during the week quite regularly after I've done a long stint. So it's not something I tend to wear as a badge of honor. I'll use it sometimes to, motivation to the mentees that I'll speak to or whatever, but nothing more than to get them to sort of harden up a little bit. But I wouldn't say that it's necessarily I wouldn't call it my greatest attribute. It's having the ability to basically almost mindlessly just repetitively execute. It is basically, it's just hours, and it's experience, and you just get, it's almost like a fitness. You just get used to it. And like I said, I've got a system for my concentration breaks and things, to make sure that I don't take it too far, which is born out of pushing it too far.
Yeah. That system of yours where if you make three reasonable errors, I shouldn't call them reasonable errors, but if you make three errors, then you call it quits for the day or for that session. Even if someone who's listening to this isn't trading for long periods like you do from time to time, do you think that might be something worthwhile adapting for themselves, like maybe a day trader?
Yeah, it's much more mistakes. Like even if I miss something, even the smallest of trades, like if it's basically three almost drops in standard. It's not. They're definitely not errors. It's most. If I miss a trade that I know that I would have normally got, or if I if I miscalculate something, or if I scratch a trade I shouldn't have scratched, or it's a really tight, high standard of things, because it's such an efficient. The market's so efficient these days, and you're competing against the best people in our market. So you can't really afford to be half-assed. So it's definitely something you could adapt to, a day trading thing, because I think you probably would, for a day trader, I think you'd probably extend the time frame depending on how long the time frame is for your trading. So just setting yourself a standard, essentially, and having a rules where you it triggers a point of review or a point of not necessarily stopping, the point where you have to step away, I think is a very good idea, because there's a definite tendency I've noticed with, particularly intense professional trainers, is that you work harder when you're doing badly and you tend to work less when you're doing well, which if you think about it, it's quite insane, because in a period where you're statistically doing worse, why would you put yourself in front of the screen more? And it's, but having those rules preset to try and avoid overworking when you're not seeing it, or the market conditions don't suit you, or getting lazy because things are going well when you should be actually probably putting your foot on the gas and taking advantage of a period where you're doing really well, I think is really important. And it's a very common thing that happens to a lot of traders, that whole reverse hours to success rate. So
yeah, I really like that idea. I mean, it's such a simple rule, but it could be also very effective. And I'm sure it's probably saved you a lot of money over the years.
Yeah, but it's also, it's really important to set it in a neutral state. Like, a lot of people will go and a lot of guys I've mentored, you have a bad day and you go and set a whole new bunch of rules. And you tend to do that in a negative frame of mind. And I've sort of fixed up someone sent me through a list of process rules the other night, and red heading, and it was all about don't not, and it's not because you're angry about the fact that you've lost. And so just even changing a more passive color to the text, and removing the points a bit more constructive, because the next time you need them you don't need a piece of paper on the wall that's effectively barking at you, because you're already under the pump. It would make you feel worse. So I think it's really important to set these rules in a neutral mindset, and not as a reactive measure. So, and people generally are sensible enough to know what to do. I think where people become emotionally unstuck is that it's just the assumption that I'm sensible, but you're always. I think Mike Tyson had a great line that, everyone's got a great plan for the fight until they step in the ring and get hit. And when you're basically trying to compensate for periods where you're not in your best frame of mind, it's best not to make a plan when you're in that mode. And also try to keep positive in terms of the rules, because you tend to lean on them when it's a bad period, and you need that little bit of positive light to help you just drag you out of a bad psychological state. So it's words like don't do this, I don't think are very helpful.
You've seen the headlines. Bonds are making a comeback. But if you've ever tried to invest in bonds, you know what a clunky, complicated, broken experience it can be. That's why at Public, they took fixed income and fixed it. Now you can find, evaluate, and buy thousands of bonds with an investing experience designed this century. They started at the beginning, reimagining the bond screener with an intuitive design that helps you zero in on the exact kinds of bonds you're looking for. Then they made it easier to evaluate each investment opportunity with better data in the places you need it most. Finally, they made investing in bonds as straightforward as stocks or any other asset. Add fixed income to your portfolio with corporate, treasury, and municipal bonds. Go to public.com/bondspodcast to get started. This podcast is sponsored by Public. Full disclosures can be found at public.com/bonds.
Are you a developing or seasoned day trader who trades the U.S. markets? Is the only thing stopping you from getting to the next level is having enough capital to trade? Trade the Pool is a unique online stock trading prop firm that funds stock traders worldwide. Not having to risk your own capital can help you focus on other things like making better decisions on your trades. There's no PDT rules to worry about. You got more than 12,000 stocks and ETFs to trade, long or short, and professional tools at your side. How you get funded is you show them your skills through a straightforward evaluation process. Once you pass the evaluation, you get funded and trade with their pool of money and split the profits. Don't let the lack of buying power, capital, or fear of losing your own money prevent you from taking your trading to the next level. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
Well, Mark, kind of skipped over this at the start. I normally open the interview by talking about this, but no harm switching the order up. So tell us a little bit about how you actually got into trading, because we haven't heard much about your backstory. So I think you got into trading or financial markets at least straight out of high school. I think you're about 17 years old. Tell us about how you got your start. I mean, we won't spend too much time on this, but just for a bit of context, yeah, it'd be interesting to hear your backstory.
Essentially, I'm in Australia. In your third last year of high school, you have to do work experience, and it was just a family connection who knew someone who worked on the trading floor. And at 14 years of age, I walked down onto the floor and to collect the chits, the dockets that all the traders write on. And it's a very much a case of being in awe of the bright lights. And I went, this is absolutely what I'm going to do. So I literally went back every 3 to 6 months. I get in the school holidays for the next few years because I was not necessarily obsessed, but just enthralled. Everyone always has romanticizes the floor because it's exciting, it's chaotic, and it's fairly intriguing to most people. Then, as a 14, 15-year-old kid, you're just like, wow. So, and then I literally 5 days out of 5 days after my last exam, I got a job with the company that I'd done continuous work experience or short stint internships, I guess you could call it. Yeah, and started five days after my last high school exam, and I think I was just 17 and 3 months old or something like that. So it was I got my broking license before I could buy a beer. So it was strange that I could advise on futures and not buy alcohol, but.
I think that says a lot that you were doing work experience, because I did a stint of work experience when I was still in school. And I remember when school holidays came up, I told them I couldn't come in because it was school holidays and I didn't want to be going in doing work experience. But sounds like for you, work experience was unpaid and you were still willing to go there during your school holidays. Did I catch that right?
Yeah. It was something I definitely wanted to do. I grew up in a small country town and the options were generally fairly limited in terms of having to stay up there. And I wouldn't say I'm the most studious person. I have a very large thirst for knowledge, but I don't like reading. So I do a lot of audio books and things like that. But so university wasn't really difficult to do a degree when you don't like books.
Okay. So when you turned 17 and you got this job after school, what actually was that job doing? Were you working on the exchange floor or were you doing something else?
Initially, I was, it was mailroom. It was the time before email, so I still had to I had to fold statements into envelopes for the clients and run errands and be a runner down to the floor occasionally. And then probably about 6 months in, because I had one of the old MS-DOS computers, and when I was younger, we were, the market was sort of, it was about 96, I think. So they were moving towards screen trading, and I was very quick and on the keyboard. So I essentially ended up just gradually drifting into the overnight broking department of the company. And I was cheap and took a lot of orders and with no errors. So that's where I ended up being. So, and in those days, guys would come off the floor and be trading at nighttime. So no one had their own terminals. And so you, as a broker in those days, you actually took quite a large number of orders because no one could self-execute. So
I believe it at some point after, I'm not sure how long you kept this up for, but at some point, a fairly big trader, I'm not sure exactly what this man traded, but he came along and sort of scooped you up and you started working for him. Can you tell us a little bit about how that played out?
Essentially, I was executing for this guy on a broking desk on a give up basis, and we basically did a deal on exclusivity, and I worked for him, him and him only. He traded, that's where I learned a fair bit of methodology of what I do. It's the same market, slightly different. Over time, I've sort of developed my own style, but short-term interest rate, Australian market, bank bills, three-year bonds and things like that. So he's a very, very tough, strict, which was very good for me because having being instantly successful at being quick on the keyboard at a young age bred a certain arrogance, I suppose, and he set the standard somewhat higher again. It was very difficult working for him, but if I had my time again, I'd do it again because it really taught me about basically you can't ever you know, you can't ever let your process drop. You can't ever drop your standards. You can't ever, you know, we'd make money in the morning and we'd miss a small trade in the afternoon, and he'd be furious. And he's like, well, you know, you can't base inefficiency just because we did well this morning doesn't mean you've got an excuse to miss that, no matter how much it is. Like, it's an uncompromising set of standards, which I've sort of has held me in very good stead, I think, in future, really. So, yeah, but albeit very tough, but it was something I think I needed.
Yeah, I mean, obviously looking back on it now, it seems like something that was very beneficial. At the time, I mean, how did you take it?
I did a lot of running and basically, and I guess I didn't, maybe in my heart of hearts, I knew that I probably needed a little bit of that it was going to be beneficial down the line. I don't really know, but it was because it was a high set of standards, he was a very good bloke, and he looked after me, but it was the unpleasant nature of it was not malicious. It was just, you know, watching someone with consistent, significant hunger, it was in hindsight, being yelled at, it was unpleasant, but it was, you know, I mean, it was also fairly inspirational because it was relentless, which was, it was pretty impressive to watch.
What were some of the standards? Like, obviously not missing trades and not missing opportunities. I mean, are there any other standards besides what we've already sort of spoken about?
It was concentration primarily, and essentially always performing at, you know, at bad peak level. When there was time off, have a lunch or something, and that was, but when you're at work, it was like, you know, I'm an elite sportsman in a way. Like, if we're here, we're doing this like at 1,000%, and there can be no mistakes. And yeah, so it was from anything from just process of managing my book, developing, it was as in his order book, you know, developing spreadsheets or ways to better represent positions so we could do it faster than the rest of the market, making sure that I had, was keeping an eye on news, having a routine in the morning where he knew what was coming out, and I was always over economic releases. And I guess in a way, the greatness was doing, they often say, greatness is doing a lot of small things really well. And it was the little things. There was no significant, the trade strategy in itself wasn't particularly complicated, but it was the level in which we executed that was our difference. And I think everyone's well aware of the, you know, failure rates within trading futures or general day trading. No, it's if you compare it to, say, elite sport, like you can't expect to win a marathon if you don't train. Like, it's time put in for what you take out in terms of, you know, if you want to operate at that elite level, if you want to be in the top 10 or 5% or 2%, then you basically have to do what other people aren't willing to do. And you can't really describe it as a job or a hobby, because in my experience, that's not really a, but that's to say, that's my experience though. If anyone can, I can, please give them my phone number. But it is a zero-sum game, and it's very, it's tough. Like, the top 10% will always eat the bottom 90%, no matter what. So you just got to make it. You got to make sure that you're in that top part. You got to be doing the things that, you know, that they do, or setting the standards, or at least having a point of difference that puts you into that elite category, really. So
yeah. So how long did you work with this trader before going out onto your own to trade your own book?
It was about 4 or 5 years maybe, and he decided to have a break, and he moved offshore. And essentially, I mean, as much as I wanted to trade, I was very conservative, and I kind of didn't have the gumption to go. So I was actually almost, when he was moving, he said, well, I don't have a job for you, but, you know, you can trade for me. I'm not forced, because I would have found a job broking, but I was pushed, and I'm very glad I did. In hindsight, I should have done it much earlier. It was certainly not a I wouldn't call myself a very risk hungry person, and especially at that stage. So it was not exactly a glorious story in terms of how it started, but that sort of conservative nature and not necessarily fear, but risk aversion is probably what kept me so consistent over the following sort of 10 years. So
yeah, well, talk to us about that. Like how did you go once you actually went out on your own and you were trading your own book? I mean, what were those first couple of years like for you?
Because it had the background and I'd been working with a very good trader, my execution and those small things were already sort of taken care of. Like I had a 10-year apprenticeship really. So it went very well. I think I really only had maybe 2 to 3 losing months in the first 10 years I traded. So I was just always very consistent. That was doing those, not knocking it out of the park either. Like I wasn't being slightly risk averse. Also has the downside. Whilst you don't take the big hits, you're not going to get the big wins either generally. So, but gradually towards the, it was probably about 3 or 4 years ago, the penny dropped and I had a foundation of capital behind me where I could take on bigger positions and risk, and I became confident and was able to psychologically handle those swings. So the first, obviously in 2005, I think I started trading for myself, and whilst into the credit crisis, which was a disaster for in terms of liquidity for this bank bill and 3-year markets, so had to change methodology there, and then going to the GFC, so volumes dropped, and the same thing, and then gradually built up to 2013 through 2015 in a much more mean reverting range bound markets, which and size just very exponentially increased, so by 1,000% sort of thing. So, but that also led to the, because I lost the risk aversion but I had the consistency and the track record, it sort of led to a bit of a sense of arrogance, basically, which led to my first significant hit, which I thoroughly deserved, because I started to get a bit of an assumption that I don't lose, and as soon as you start thinking that, and there's consequences.
Okay, well let's talk about this a little bit. Just going off something Tony had mentioned to me when he first reached out, he said, and I just want listeners to understand how consistent you were leading up to this point. You only had 2 losing months. I mean, you can correct me if this is not true.
It'd be in the first decade, it'd be 2 to 3 losing months, and they were minimal.
So what happened in 2015? What went wrong there?
Essentially, I was a situation in the market probably 3 months prior, and I had been doing very well, coming off of my best year ever, and I took someone on in the market, and I got lucky, basically. Well, I didn't get lucky, but I won, and I think that definitely created a bit of a God complex, I guess, in a way, which kind of set me up for the next time, which was in March, 2015, where that probably made the fall in March significantly worse. It was that constant run, and I also I'm a very goal oriented person, and I sort of started to feel like I'd achieved. I'd become a partner and taken over a prop shop that I was at, and I'd started the trade association, and that was going in Australia, and that was going well, and I'd achieved the things I'd sort of set out to achieve, and without, I don't think I realized until after the significance of not having a goal was, not only was it fairly hollow, the dream's much better than the maintenance of a dream. I wasn't necessarily boredom, but a lack of direction, and that combined with arrogance, and I just took on a position far too large for the market conditions, and because I was essentially, I hadn't had any major hits before. Like even our risk was the risk department sort of thing was like, it had never happened before, basically. I mean, obviously there's delta loss limits and all those sorts of things, but it was just the thought that it wouldn't happen to me or didn't apply to me, and which made it a lot worse. And it was half a year, 6 to 7 months of a medium to good year in lost in 4 hours, and it's kind of, because I'd never really lost before, it actually hit me probably a lot harder than than it would even an amateur trader. It's like, because I'd never had to deal with the situation before, and so I just was very ill-equipped.
So how did this trade go so wrong? You said you took on a very big position, but to lose, I think you said 6 to 7 months of a good year's profit in just a couple hours. I mean, that, were there any other factors that played a part in this?
I don't want to sound like I'm making excuses for it, but there were triggers, but at the end of the day, the responsibility lay with me for the fact that I should have removed myself from the situation. But there was, I had a blackout at my house and I lost the first, so probably 20% of the evening, with basically because I couldn't call out. It was a lightning strike and mobile towers went out, so I'd lost a significant amount of money with not being able to cancel my orders. But I didn't calm myself down when I came back on and got everything back up and running. And it was just a perfect storm of bad personality traits. So immediately chasing, getting very angry, and thinking that I'm usually quite good. I'm quite good at hedging my way out of trouble or whatever. And I essentially tried to fix it all in too short a period of time in a bad headspace. And then the position gets too large, and then it was large enough that there wasn't enough liquidity generally for me to get out. It was a rollover period as well, where the correlations tend to very much decouple. So all of my normal hedges didn't exist. So I ended up with an outright position, which I wasn't an outright trader. Like generally, I was a relative value trader. So it just snowballed. But it could have very well easily been solved by if I had someone to say, calm down, I let my headspace. Usually, 99.9% of the time, I'm very level and very calm. So it's almost like stress thresholds for the average person are, say they're 20 of an inch wide, for instance. But because people, with the normal stress threshold, will regularly have not a freak out, but they'll regularly experience points of where things overwhelm them. But there's a disadvantage as well being having a broad stress threshold, because the irregularity at which you actually break means that you're actually far less capacity to deal with it. So it's like a breakout and a standard deviation breakouts in trades and tech. It's like once it gets through a point where it hasn't normally gotten to, there's a lot of bad stops. So I should have had the experience or the maturity enough to walk away, but I did the opposite. So that's what I mean. But I, in terms of this, the situation surrounding it is that I don't generally like to talk about the beginning of the situation that night, because that happens. Things will always happen to you that you can't avoid. I really feel the need to take complete ownership of the fact that that wasn't the reason.
Yeah. So let me ask you, I guess, two things. Have you done anything to sort of safeguard yourself in the event that something like this happens again, in terms of like blackout or you don't have access to power?
Yeah, I've got two UPSs and sitting in my screens in here, and I've got a petrol generator that'll run me for 30 hours. So,
okay, and so you got those installed after this for this particular reason?
Yeah, basically. So, and it really led me to really tighten up my redundancy measures. So, in terms of I got a secondary system in case my system went down. We were two separate brokers, and I plug in the handset phones, the normal house phones. They don't need electricity, so I actually had to go and try and find one of those, which was quite difficult, because and basically make myself a little bit more bulletproof, and even to the point of I had a system failure that a few days ago, but I have a secondary computer with everything very loaded on it that I can literally, like, all I gotta do is switch the screens and I'm back up. So that's not probably measures that anyone below a day trader would necessarily need, but if you sort of think about it, like a redundancy package, which I'm actually looking at putting together, not so necessarily as a business, because the volume wouldn't be good enough, but if you spend $1,200, you can possibly avoid a $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 incident. And I think it's something that a lot of people overlook, is that it seems like a lot of money at the time, but you know, it's definitely a having it happen to me, probably, or similar situations happened 3 times. That, you know, it's sort of money well spent, really.
Insurance worthwhile having.
It's when you buy insurance for your house or your car. So it's a one-off insurance policy, I suppose.
Yeah. And it's probably tax deductible.
Exactly.
And the other thing I was going to ask you, so let's fast forward to the following day or the next couple of days. How did you move forward from this? Like, you'd just taken the biggest hit in your career. Like you said, you weren't in a good space. How did you handle this event in the coming days, like moving forward? And how long did it actually take you to recover from this loss?
Immediately, actually, that little bit of arrogance or self-confidence or whatever you want to call it, I made a lot back very quickly, like the following day. And it wasn't really till the weekend when I just sort of got to, you know, just sit down and take stock, where it, you know, the gravity of it hit me. So that was kind of when, and also having, when you go from being, you know, Mr. Consistent, and people, you know, you start to doubt you. I had my, you know, having your first discussion with risk, you know, in your career sort of thing. Like, it did rattle me a little bit, and it probably took, it was about 6 months, maybe 5.5 months, 6 months to make it back in full. But there was definitely an inconsistency in my trading, which had never been there before, because I couldn't balance the being a very confident trader and also trying to get back to being a little bit more respectful of risk management. So it took me a while to find the balance, and yeah, it was the first time I really had, you know, probably two voices in my head instead of, you know, knowing what I needed to do. I think I had, up until that was the point where I just, you know, had the 3 losing months or two on what I think I had maybe two or three losing months over the next 6. So it definitely affected me, but it also, realistically, strange thing to say, but probably one of the better things that happened to me, because there was a complacency in my strategy. Things were going well, so I wasn't looking elsewhere for ways to improve and develop. And I basically I started to learn how to safeguard myself. So I you know, put in place a routine for when I have a bad day. I now feel equipped to cope with it, and not in the sense of, you know, I'll be right, because I mean, you know, I've been doing this forever. It's much more of a, you know, reflective and, you know, regaining your respect for the market a little bit. So
sure. Okay, Mark. Well, we're getting on a little bit, but there's still one thing I'd really like to speak with you about, and you've kind of hinted at this a little bit earlier. You said that, you know, you feel that your edge in the market has gotten smaller over the past, you know, 15 years. And more recently, you've been getting into more quantitative methods of trading, you know, pursuing more systematic strategies. How come? I want to ask you that. I mean, is it just because you feel your edge or the particular way that you've been trading is getting tougher? What's the attraction to these quantitative methods of trading?
It's definitely a tougher market, but you would generally find a way. It's a desire to be a much broader scope of strategies, more scalable strategies. But I guess what it comes down to is that who I'm competing against now is people who run systematic and quantitative strategies. Primarily, you know, it used to be trader on trader generally, and I guess the critical mass of volume and reaction was we're human beings, and that's changed. And I'm not up against one guy sitting in a terminal now. I'm up against a team of, you know, an actuary, a mathematician, or a coder, and a coder and quant, like, and looking for, you know, probably significantly less return on capital than over a broader amount of contracts over 3 shifts, instead of, you know, a human being can do like one or two shifts a day tops in one market. Like, a quant strategy can do, you know, can trade 20 markets, three shifts a day, and they don't get tired, they don't get emotional. I just realized that the rules had changed, the competition had changed, and so I had to learn the new playbook. I had to improve myself and really adapt to my methodology to who I'm competing against, because it's a zero-sum game. So you've got to be better than the best people, and now those sets of teams are sort of not necessarily dominating, but they've taken advantage of the inefficiencies of human traders, and that's why there's been a large level of attrition.
So how have you gone about approaching this? Because, you know, your last 15 years, you've been primarily a discretionary trader. I think that's fairly accurate to say, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So how have you approached this kind of new way of doing things?
There's a quite a good article that I read recently that explained much more concisely than I'm probably going to put it now. I think there's a very distinct gap in both intuitive traders and logical traders or logical strategies, because they both need to be very good, though. I think they both need each other. But I mean, have you ever seen an IT guy and a trader try and have a conversation? It's quite interesting, because they don't have a level of respect for each other's expertise. So, you know, maths guys will always stick to the maths, and the traders will have, you know, more of an intuitive based, adaptive unconscious, I think they call it. I mean, I don't like using the word gut feel, because I think it really discredits, you know, the intuitive skill that, you know, a discretionary trader has, or a successful discretionary trader has. But, you know, abstract, you know, the use of abstract reasoning, pattern recognition, which is just, the reason I can't explain it is because it's an unconscious absorption over many, many hours in front of the screen, but the mathematical strategy style job trading shops or trading groups, they don't have. I'm trying to, I've got two young guys working for me, and this is going to sound strange, but specifically with no previous experience in the particular field, but obviously Tony has he's got a very strong background in maths, and Michael's got, he's very much more that abstract or creative side. So, I'm essentially trying to avoid doing what everyone else has done in that space and try and marry up the two, you know, forms of thinking, because I really think that there's a definite advantage for a human trader armed with the efficiency of an algorithm or an algorithmic team or a mathematical team or statistics would be quite a sight to behold, I think. And until I get to a point where I'm stuck, I'm really trying to avoid bringing someone into, because I don't want to blinker or reduce the scope of looking in areas that we haven't, you know, that other people haven't looked in before, but really avoiding that, using the confirmation bias or, you know, similarity bias. Like, people tend to gravitate towards things that are similar and things that back up their argument. So, and it's a great book, the new book by Michael Lewis, The Undoing Project, and the first chapter is very much about, he found in Moneyball that the scouts, when they were in the draft, they, no matter how much they said they were being unbiased, they went through and basically proved that they were. The first impression was always, you know, was always made. They were always made on terms of, like, they tended to like players that were, you know, that used to play like them, or they, on a race point of view, basketball, it was the example they were using. You know, there was never an Indian player in the NBA, so the people had tried, and they just wouldn't get picked out of, when in fact their statistics were comparable, if not better. But it's a great insight into the human brain. Subconsciously makes a lot of decisions, and those biases, the mathematical and algorithmic side can fix, but the creativity side, realistically, only a human can do, because it's the amount of complex calculations and the swiftness of, you know, being adaptive that, you know, I think could complement each other. So,
yeah, I think that movie, or even the book, I haven't read the book, but I've watched the movie. Moneyball is a must watch for every trader, for sure.
Yeah, it's just, I really try to make an effort to push myself to not surround myself with people of, not necessarily people of like mind, but I try to really try to challenge myself to talk to people who, you know, do something different to me, and not in a dismissive way, but just to try and get a different outlook. Particularly, like a lot of people, I've noticed a lot of locals or prop traders, if they're having a bad run, they'll always cuddle up to someone who's having a bad run too. So it's almost a it's okay because everyone else is having a bad run too. But whereas I sort of try and do the opposite. Well, if I'm having a particularly poor run, I'll really try and force myself. And as much as it can be painful, to someone who's doing really well, because I see it as a way, like, you can learn what to do to change, or at least you're gonna hopefully pull in some of that positivity.
Absolutely, very good, Mark. Well, let's leave it at that for now. I know you don't really have much in the way of like an online presence or online profile. Is there anything you want to mention? Like, if someone wants to get in touch with you or find out more about you, I think you're probably on LinkedIn or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I've got LinkedIn, and I've got at 42 Trading is a Twitter, and I've got a sort of bit of software, dualmouse.com, which is a dual cursor product for sort of designed for, you know, for traders, essentially, you know, to be able to be collaborative and system share and things like that. So,
what's the link for that?
Dualmouse.com, dualmouse.com.
Okay, excellent. And at 42 Trading on Twitter. Yep, cool.
Yeah, no problems.
All right, Mark, well, let me just say thank you very much for doing this. I've enjoyed speaking to you, so thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
You've reached the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but rest assured, there are more episodes loaded with real market insight and zero hype on the way soon. So to stay updated with each great new release, subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you'd leave a rating and review. We'll catch you next time on Chat with Traders.